Now, that was his Beach Boys. Wouldn't it be nice? And the Beach Boys who opened this track and their album in 1966, becoming this huge hit. But what I said earlier was the Beach Boys. It was not the Beach Boys, but of course it was Buddy Holly singing Peggy Sue Got Married, where he recorded on this day in 1959. It was the last song he recorded before he died. So I just want to clear that up, and we'll move ahead with our program. I'll remind you, you're listening to the Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word. That's MarylandEducators.org. Or you can go to SteinerShow.org, click on their banner. Between now and the end of the session, their banner will be up on our Annapolis session, that is, on our website, and you can get all the information right there. We are going to tackle a subject that we have been tackling on this program for 20 years, which is, A, the question of when do people have a right to a lawyer? Is it at their initial bail hearing? And the question of whether we need a bail bond industry in the state of Maryland. And as you know, over the last few months, we've had some intense discussions with some of the people who are now on this program and others. On September 25th, is that the right date? Yes. The Maryland Court of Appeals, the highest court, made a decision that that everyone has a right to a lawyer at their initial bail hearing in front of a commissioner or judge, whatever that system is, in whatever part of the state it is. So during our Annapolis summit, we raised that issue, and we'll be hearing some clips from the summit from the governor and the president of the Senate specifically that responded to my questions and other questions about this issue. And it became clear at that at the Annapolis summit that the governor and the president of the Senate making it clear that they didn't agree with the decision handed down by the Court of Appeals. And they were almost thinking about how they're going to abrogate it. And the new head of the court wrote the dissenting opinion in that case and has agreed to hear it again. There are a number of reasons. Some people think that this was a political move so that they don't have to come up with $30 million extra dollars, where that number is, to pay for public defenders who would have to be there. Others, as I said, and we'll hear a clip, are basically saying that they thought this was a political act by the former chief judge. So this is a very complex issue, both politically, legally, in terms of human rights, in terms of who stays in our prisons and who gets out, our jails and who gets out, who has a right to bail, who doesn't. Is the system working? What are other states doing that may be working better or not? So we are going to engage this during the course of this hour and invite you to join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at SteinerShow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages. We are joined by Doug Colbert, who's professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law, who has been leading the charge over the last 20 years for the right of lawyer at their initial bail hearing. We're joined by Paul DeWolfe, who is Maryland's chief public defender, head of public defender's office in Maryland, Scott Schellenberger, who is the elected Baltimore County state's attorney, Tom Maronick, who is a Baltimore attorney and host of his own radio show, The Tom Moore Show, and was involved in our debates here in the past around the bail bonds industry. So welcome, gentlemen. Good to have you all with us.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Mark.
410-319-8888 is the number here to join in on this conversation. We want to hear your thoughts. There's a lot to talk about. And we'll start by, let me just ask you, Doug, first, just only because it was your law clinic and you along with a law firm.
Yeah, two wonderful lawyers from the Venable Law Firm.
Venable Law Firm that initiated this suit that ended up with this decision on September 25th. So talk just a little bit about the issue. Not long, because we have a lot of guests here. We want to get to these questions. So talk about why you initiated this initially, and then I want to hear our guests go to Scott and kind of have his response.
Yeah, Mark, I appreciate the opportunity and want to make it clear from the outset to keep in mind that progress is being made, and at the same time, change is difficult. So we certainly celebrated the Court of Appeals ruling last September, where they indicated for the first time that poor people low-income people have a constitutional right to a lawyer, to a public defender's representation when their liberty is first at stake. That was a tremendous victory for the equal justice, for the even playing field that we associate with the lawyer's presence and advocacy when our when we're first before a judge. What we see in our system is that the justice has always been most difficult for people who don't have money, who are either poor or low income, who are people of color, and it's hit very hard in the African American and Latino American community, and that's because it took a long time in this country before a constitutional right to a lawyer was recognized in 1963, and it came about largely because of Dr. King and others' war on poverty. And he was able, and others were able, to connect the injustices in states' criminal justice systems, which prosecuted people often without a lawyer and often kept people in jail before trial solely because they didn't have the bail money. So there's a history that we have to take in account when almost 50 years later, Maryland's highest court delivers this landmark ruling. And we know it's difficult to implement a right that hasn't been there before. And change is something that is going to be difficult when people are accustomed, and I say people, I'm talking about judges, prosecutors, defense lawyers, we're all accustomed to the system operating at the beginning without a lawyer by an accused side. But we also take a great deal of solace in the idea that the governor's task force, pretrial task force, has heard recommendations from the pretrial committee that would require a risk assessment. And a risk assessment would give judges information that would allow them to make an objective decision about whether people should go free or stay in jail. And at the same time, that task force has also called for the elimination of money bail, which truly discriminates against those who have and those who don't have.
So let me turn to Scott. Scott, I mean, I wonder why there is – explain to us from your perspective, which you've done before, why there's been so much opposition from the beginning to this idea of lawyers at bail. At the initial bail hearing, I mean to say.
Me on. Good morning, Professor Paul and Tom. I hearken back now to your Beach Boys song, you know, and think, wouldn't it be nice if we had $30 million to fix this problem? You know, we have to have some perspective here, and that is, you know, all the things the professor was talking about are very important and are good. But in Maryland, we have a very strong public defender system that Paul runs, and they've been representing people at trial, at preliminary hearings, at all kinds of hearings for decades now. So the issue becomes, when is it most important to have a free lawyer? And the Court of Appeals a couple years ago ruled that by statute that it should be at the first initial appearance. The legislature came in last year and changed that and said, okay, we're going to move it way back, and you get a free lawyer at your 24-hour bail review if you're still in jail. And the problem with moving it back to the initial appearance is that it requires an incredible amount of resources, and you don't get much return on your investment. So here's the problem. In 2011, there were approximately 176,000 of these appearances at 41 different places all over this state. So how do you have the money to put a lawyer at every one of those appearances, particularly when the stats show that half of them get out within about 4 or 5 hours with no bail at all? So you're giving a free lawyer to about 80,000 people who really don't need one. And then the other problem is there's another 7,000 people that the law says a commissioner cannot release by statute if you're charged with a very serious crime like murder, rape, certain robberies. So you're talking about, you know, over 85,000 people who either haven't needed a lawyer in the past or a lawyer can't help because the commissioner doesn't have the ability to release them. So do you want to spend that amount of money on this kind of thing, particularly when within 24 hours you get a lawyer if you're still in jail? So you really have to look at the bang for the buck. And look, I agree some reforms are necessary. I was on the governor's task force. I participated in all the meetings. Absolutely, we can make some changes and make some reforms. But if you want to give everybody a free lawyer at the initial stage, those 176,000 hearings, you're talking about $30 million, and I think we can spend $30 million in the criminal justice system a lot smarter and a lot better.
So before we come back to that, I know you want to jump right back in, but I'm curious, Paul DeWolf, as the man who runs the public defender's office, what's your response to all this, and how do you fit into this debate? How have you fit into this debate?
Yes, Mark, thank you so much for having me on your program.
Good to have you with us.
I think it's important to remember what the court said, the Court of Appeals said in the Richmond decision, and that is at the point at which a person's liberty is at stake, and that is when the decision is made whether that person is released or is detained, that triggers a constitutional right to counsel under the Maryland Declaration of Rights. And so they have elevated this hearing to a constitutional dimension. But what this debate has also triggered is a look at the pretrial detention system in general. It has been a scandal throughout Maryland and really throughout the United States. And I think Doug Colbert mentioned it when he was speaking, and that is the fact is if you have money, no matter what you're charged with, almost without question, you can get relief. However, if you're poor and you don't have resources, you stay in jail. So this decision and this task force that the three of us are on has brought about the possibility of some real reform in the pretrial detention system. Most importantly, the focus on money bail, the focus on financial security as a reason for either releasing a person or detaining a person has been looked at in a very close way, and studies have shown and best practices have also shown that money does not predict whether someone is going to be a risk to the community or whether they're going to return to court. All it really does, effectively, is divide people between those who have money and those who don't have money. And the fact that the task force has recommended the abolition of money bail in Maryland is a huge, huge step forward, should it be adopted. The second thing that the task force has looked at is when the decision is made as to whether or not someone is detained or released, that decision should be made on the basis of risk and not on the basis of money. And what I mean by that is that Scott Schellenberger mentioned the 50% of the people that are released by a commissioner. Those, by and large, are low-risk people. And the task force has recommended that we use a risk assessment tool so that those low-risk people can be identified at the outset and be released without condition. There's a middle group, those who pose a smaller risk than the high-risk people, and they would necessarily be supervised in the community. And that supervision can be anywhere from call-in to a pretrial worker to electronic monitoring. And then the third group are the high-risk people, and those people would typically be detained. And they pose not only a risk for not showing up for court, but a true risk to the safety of the community. So those reforms, in addition to the concept of having attorneys at bail, at the bail decision, are among the more important recommendations that have come out of this whole Richmond decision.
Before we turn to Tom Moronic, I want to play this clip, and I come back to kind of ask this political question about this and what any of these reforms would mean for the future of people and our system. Folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888, where you're about to hear took place at the Annapolis Summit on the opening day of the session during our Annapolis Summit. This is a question I'm asking of the President of the Senate, Mike Miller. If any one of us had a loved one who was arrested,
right,
we would have the means to call a lawyer, go there, be there for their bail hearing, make sure that they're taken care of. Doesn't this law...
It's not the bail hearing. See, that's where you're confused. The lay people don't understand that. It's before a commissioner who is not even a lawyer.
So yes, they make these decisions.
The Court of Appeals say, you now need a lawyer to advise you to go before a commissioner who's not even a lawyer.
But they're the ones who say whether you are going to stay in jail, whether you can go home. Right?
Well, that what it is, the courts appoint a commissioner who's not even a lawyer to decide whether people get hauled over for bail or whether they get released right away. We want some judge or some pre-release agency, somebody with some expertise, and we want to give them a menu and say, these type of cases, hold them over for a bail hearing. These type of cases, let them go home to their loved ones.
So there's another piece where he talks, maybe we'll play a little bit later, where he talks about the chief judge. Which I think is an important part of what's going on here politically, and both chief judges, former and present. And so I wonder, when we hear all this, Tom Maronic, both your kind of legal hat and your observer hat, I mean, there's some politics going on here that is interesting to me. It's the politics of when the President of the Senate says that he thought that Judge Bell, without naming Judge Bell, was making a political act in making this decision as a tweak against the governor on his way out. When people are talking about how he would to address the cost of putting this right that the Court of Appeals said was a right into action, and even what Mr. DeWolf was just saying, that if we got rid of the bail bond system, which we'll talk about in a moment, that also would take a restructuring of our system to make it work. So there's a lot of politics involved in this decision that goes beyond just wrangling over legal, ethical, and human rights questions.
This is a situation where you have to keep in mind how much things are going to cost. I mean, and this is not a slight change that's a tweak to the system. This is a major, major overhaul, and I understand why Mike Miller is saying that, because this money doesn't grow on trees, and I know that you also talked about in the summit about taxes and the recent tax increases, and they've got to come up with the money somehow. So if we're going to hold our politicians accountable for tax increases that are very unfathomable on other issues, or certainly unsavory, if not unfathomable, then, you know, when something like this happens, you have to wonder, you know, is there a political element? Is there something beyond just what's being put out there because of the tremendous costs involved? And I think Scott brought up that point earlier about just the massive costs that are involved. And I actually agree with Doug and with Paul as far as if this is indeed a constitutional right, that there ought to be a lawyer there. But I think when the decision was made, maybe not all of those facets were taken into account as far as some of the points Scott brought up.
This is Doug Colbert. Go ahead. Then we'll go back to Scott Schellner.
So, Mark, whenever there's a constitutional right, the state must implement that right, and it's going to cost some money. It cost money in 1963 when the Supreme Court said in Gideon case that every poor person is entitled to a lawyer at trial. State said, how are we going to pay for this? It's going to cost too much money. This government doesn't like to spend money on poor people who are accused of crime. They've never allocated sufficient money to the public defender to represent people the way public defenders would like to. We understand that. But we have to accept the Court of Appeals ruling. There is now a constitutional right to a lawyer. And that's fundamental to our justice system. It's fundamental at the very first stage when people's liberties first at stake. I agree with many of the things that Mr. Schellenberg has said, but what I don't agree with is that people are not waiting 24 hours for a bail review. If you get arrested on a Thursday, you're not going to see a bail review judge until Monday. Now, that's 3-4 days there, and if there is a holiday on Monday, as there was for Dr. King's birthday, you're waiting in jail for 5 days. Now, if any of us are waiting in jail for one day before we see a lawyer, before we see a judge, and then when we see the judge, someone has already put a bail on us, We have to overcome that bail, and then we have to wait several more days in jail. That's what the Court of Appeals of Maryland said is unconstitutional. So we have to accept that the ruling must be implemented. And the law is very clear, Mark. It's not 50% of the people who should be released. The law says that every person is entitled to release on recognizance or on conditions that are the least onerous, meaning that you can't set a high money bail on people who don't have money. The law is very clear that people are entitled unless there's absolutely no condition that will get them back to court or prevent them from being a danger to the community. So when we look at 50%, that's half the people who are still in jail. If they had a lawyer and effective representation, taxpayers would not be spending the amount of money that we are to keep people in jail on low-level crime. So what Scott said about there's no benefit, we have shown that there are enormous cost savings to all of us by keeping the people in jail who must be held until trial because they do represent a danger, and making sure that all the others are released, not on a price tag that they have to pay, but with the supervision that this risk assessment will provide. So we really have to stay focused here on implementation and risk assessment. And what's disturbing, to me at least, about the proposal that the judiciary put forward, it doesn't include risk assessment. It's going to allow judges to make uninformed decisions where I think all of us agree that we want something that's objective. We want that scientific evaluation. Will this person come back? Will she not go out and be charged with a new crime?
So, Scott, let me ask you to come back in this and to kind of comment on what you heard Doug say. And also, I mean, we know that this case is about to go back before Judge Mary Ellen Barbera.
Well, it's about to go back in front of seven judges.
No, no, I know. I say that because she was the dissenting opinion in the original case. She's now chief judge.
Correct.
That's why I was alluding rather than being very clear. So some people would say that, okay, that means at some level it may be overturned.
Well, you have a lot of different things going on here. Number one, back to your original question about Mike Miller, you know, take the personalities out of it. This is also about, you know, one branch of government, judiciary, who doesn't have taxing authority, telling another branch of government, the executive, how they should spend their money and how much extra they should spend. And then you have the legislative branch who kind of has to, you know, fix it by passing a statute. So it really is kind of a fascinating look at, you know, who can tell who what to do. I mean, I actually, you know, witnessed the Court of Appeals judges arguing about the rules, and one judge said, can we tell them to spend $30 million? And one of the other judges just kind of waved it off. And, you know, there was a legislator sitting behind me, and, you know, they got a big harumph out of that. So, but, yeah, I mean, you know, look, Doug's right. In 1964, when we, you know, started the public defender system and said people had a right to representation during their murder trial, their, you know, their theft trial, their armed robbery trial, yeah, that cost a lot of money, and I believe in that. And we have a great public defender system in this state, and they do a really good job. The question is back to the bang for the buck. You know, if you know, when you're at your murder trial, yeah, I can see where you have a free lawyer. When you're at your preliminary hearing, when you're at your theft case, those are really important things. When you're first arrested and half the people are walking out the door with no restrictions at all, and in my county it actually approaches almost 60%, And usually that happens within about 3 or 4 hours. The problem with what this decision does is it not only costs a lot of money, you're not getting a lot of return for investment when half the people are getting out. I think Doug's right. You know, should a person arrested on a Friday when there's a holiday have to wait till Tuesday if they first were denied by the commissioner and then they're still in jail? Maybe not. Maybe we can have a baby step forward to get them a bail review in front of a judge on the weekend. But I got to tell you, Mark, you know, we've been providing lawyers to people who have stayed in jail within 24 hours. We've been giving them a lawyer. And my jail population hasn't changed much at all. I don't believe having a lawyer at these hearings is going to change the amount of people who are in jail very much, if at all. I think it's going to remain very consistent. Because what I see is the people who are released look like the people who should be released, and the people who are being held are kind of the people who should be held, and I don't think a lawyer is going to contribute much to that. The one other factor we need to look at is the cash bail system in Maryland.
Well, let me stop you there, Scott. We can take a quick break, and I want to come right back to the money bail system, and also, given this argument wrangling over where we are now, how are we going to create a just system for people arrested? Many people think too many people are being arrested. A just system for those arrested, so they have lawyers, so that they get out before they stand trial, now don't languish in jail for most of the alleged crimes that are committed. That's what I want to get to. Where, Scott, you were about to take us. We'll come right back to that with our four guests. Stay with us. Join us at 410-319-8888 with your own stories. We'll be right back.
It lingers, then you forget. Oh, oh. Rock and roll suicide.
Ah! 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 Ah!
Well, don't you know?
That's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang. That's the sound of the men.
Sam Cooke. Born on this day, and of course, he's got a comment on the lawyer's bail hearing as well with his song. So, Doug Colbert's with us, professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law, Paul DeWolf, who is Maryland Public Defender, Tom Moronic, who is a Baltimore attorney and host of the Tom Moore Show, and Scott Schellenberger, who is the Baltimore County State's Attorney, and you at 410-319-8888. We're going to come to your calls. Oh, we just lost a call. He just called in. He was part of the bail bonds industry, but Kevin called back. We want to hear what you have to say because we're about to go there. 410-319-8888. But just quick, Scott, I want to clear something very quick. We did, before we went on the air, we did kind of a look at what was going on around the state with bails, with people getting out of jail. And you made a quote. I just wanted to clear one thing up. It said, David Weissert, who is coordinator for commissioner activities in the state, said that in 2012, Baltimore County had 17,026 initial appearance hearings. And commissioners released 6,000 people, or about 6,026 people, or 35%. You gave a different number. That
35% is on RECOG. We do have people who post cash bails in Baltimore County, and I've been told our number is higher than 50%, and that it's approaching 60. Now, you know, that does go to the crux of the problem and that we've been discussing, and that is, you know, does that additional number of people who are ponying up money, you know, would they have to do that if they had had a lawyer at that initial hearing? And, you know, I haven't mentioned risk assessment. I mean, I think Paul and Professor Colbert and I do agree. We saw an excellent presentation on how to adopt an objective risk assessment. And I think we can build that tool into our Maryland system. But I do believe cash bail still has a place in Maryland because of this. Number one, very often when a cash bail is put up, it's as a result of a family member posting a portion of that money. And there are a lot of defendants who show up for court knowing that their family member could be on the hook for the rest of the money. And so I do think cash bails cause people to come to court. You don't want to see your mother or father or sister or grandmother, you know, lose out on money because you decide not to show up. So I do think cash bail still has a place in the Maryland system.
So let's talk about that for a minute. There are two things very important here. Who just said I don't?
This is Tom. This is where Scott and I disagree. I'm not a big fan of cash bails, Mark, for this reason. The cash bail means you have to come up with that exact amount of money. So if the cash bail is $10,000, you need to have the $10,000. Whereas if you have a chance at a bond, you're in a situation where you put 10% down, and then you're on the hook for the rest of that money. And while Scott's right, a lot of times this is a family member who ends up being on the hook. It's just such a disparity in money in many instances. Not all instances, but many instances where you have a cash bail versus a bail bond. And as far as the risk assessment, I know we've been getting into that. It's a situation where if you were to implement the risk assessment that has been recommended, you will put the bail bonds industry out of business. That's essentially what you do. All the jobs across the state of Maryland, from larger parts of Maryland to smaller parts, you will basically put them out of business. And then in addition to that, and this is where I think Scott and I agree, you won't have any sort of impetus for the person to come to court. If they're out, even if they're on a low-risk charge, or whatever the committee has determined to be a low risk, there's nothing holding them. There's nothing that's saying, if you don't come to court, there's something that's going to happen. Whereas if you have a bail bondsman and the person doesn't show up, there's a bondsman who will go and chase them. They'll send out a bounty hunter to bring the person to court. So you have that check and balance. And I think if you were to implement this risk assessment system, you don't have that anymore. And I think that's a huge mistake.
Can I just respond?
This is Paul DeWolf. Could I break in here?
Go, Paul and then Doug, and then we'll get to the phones. Go ahead.
Mark, that's just not the case. There are many, many examples of pretrial service agencies across the country and even here in Maryland that serve a function of making sure that people go to court. And their FTA rates are much, much better than those who rely on money bail and bondsmen to bring people back to court. The fact is, bondsmen don't bring people back to court. If someone misses court, it's the sheriff's department and the police department that go out and serve the warrants and bring the people back in. It's the rare case that a bondsman acts as a bounty hunter and actually brings the person in. That function is done by at a great cost by our sheriffs and by our police officers. Two examples that I could show you. In, for example, Montgomery County, they have a pretrial system in which when a person is released on pretrial, they're supervised in the community by workers. If the person doesn't show up, those workers go out and contact the people and contact the police, and they have a much better rate of returning people to court. Their FTA rate is about 3%. In as opposed to about 18% to 20% in places that use the bail bond system. The second example I'd like to point out is the District of Columbia. They have done away with money bail. They release about 72% of the people. About 28% of people are detained, and they're supervised in the community. The police, the prosecutors, the judges all accept the system, and they believe it to be a very well-working system. In Baltimore City, 91% of the people that are in jail are pretrial. They haven't been found guilty of anything. They're awaiting their trial. In Prince George's County, it's about 88%. And those are the two of our more the poorer communities. And the reason for that high rate of pretrial detention can be pointed directly to the fact that people can't come up with the money for the bail bondsmen. The bonds in Baltimore City are outrageous. Just sit in a bail hearing and you'll hear bonds of $20, $30, $40, $60, $100,000for offenses that in other jurisdictions like D.C. they get released on pretrial detention. And so those people do show up for court.
Paul makes some very good points, Mark. And you know, let's be clear about who the people are who are in jail, because in Baltimore, about 90% of the people in pretrial jail waiting for a trial are African American people. In other counties, in Baltimore County, it's roughly 3 to 4 times greater the number of African Americans in the general population. So there's a racial divide when you talk about money bail. There's also that money divide. It's not a rational system. In Montgomery County, that Paul worked many years before he became chief defender, you have a head of the jail there, Art Wallenstein, that believes very strongly in pretrial supervision as a way of monitoring people once they're released. He doesn't want to deal with the overload, and that's what's going to happen unless there's a risk assessment, unless there are lawyers present at the very beginning, and unless we eliminate money bail. And as far as Tom's point about no impetus, well, if you don't come to court, prosecutors can charge you with the crime of not appearing in court. And it's a crime, frankly, that ought to be prosecuted much more often, as opposed to keeping people in jail before they've had a trial solely because they don't have money. That runs smack up against the presumption of innocence, the fact that people are supposed to return to their jobs and their family, except in these limited circumstances. So what we're looking at here is where, if you ever had to set a cash bail, if I was a judge and I really agree that with Scott that there's a family involvement, put that money in the court, and then your incentive is to come back so you can get your money back. What is the rationale for paying a bail bondsman 10% non-refundable money? It's a practice that has gone on for as long as any of us can remember, and it's one that now could be replaced by something that actually determines whether the community is safe and whether people ought to be released. Not if they have the money. If you're a dangerous person and you can pay to go back on the street, frankly, we don't want you back on the street. We do want people back who are going to lead law-abiding lives, who are going to come back to court and face the charge.
So do we need then, Scott, let me ask you this question. So given what we've been talking about here, if, for argument's sake, let me paint a scenario that may happen, that the Court of Appeals may overturn what they did. That's a real possibility, and we all know that's a real possibility. But that the commission set up by – the committee set up by the in the state legislature is recommending certain things. And so does this mean that, A, that you need a risk assessment that's done, that's objective, that really has a great deal of bearing on what happens before the courts, B, that you, if you end the bail bonds industry and create a system like they have in Kentucky, like they have in Washington, a couple of the states, where everything I've read has said these systems have worked, that people go back to the communities, they can have their jobs, have their families, they come back to court, get their money back. If they're found innocent, they get their money back when they come back to court. I forget what it is.
Just if they come
back
to court.
They get their money back. That these systems, this would also mean developing a vigorous pretrial system for people who are released. But is that the system we should be designing in the state of Maryland that creates more equitable justice?
Well, I certainly think that we can have reform whether or not the Court of Appeals continues down this path or reverses itself. And certainly I can't predict what's going to happen there. I was truly impressed with this concept of a risk assessment. And really what it does is it allows a person to answer seven questions objectively that kind of determines whether you're going to show up for court or whether you're going to commit a crime while you're out of jail. And it puts you on a continuum of a low risk versus a high risk. It's really what our commissioners have been doing for the last 30 years intuitively. You know, they look at certain factors like your criminal record, like how old you were when you were first arrested, like whether you have any prior crimes of violence in your background. And it's what the commissioners are doing right now anyhow. It makes it more objective. And, yeah, fine, if we can have a scientifically based objective risk assessment, you know, that gets the low-level folks out the door quickly, you know, I think that's a great reform. And I think it's a great reform whether it's foisted upon us by the Court of Appeals or whether the legislature decides in its wisdom that it's a good idea. But here's another thing about cash bails and bail bond industry people don't know. If a bondsman puts up, you know, say a $10,000 bond and I flee to Kentucky and he finds me in Kentucky and I have to extradite that person, I can charge the bondsman the amount of money for extradition. And we do that in this state all the time. Bondsmen are responsible for the entire amount. And so, you know, that saves the state money because I actually have to, my office pays for extradition costs. We spend, you know, maybe $30,000 or more a year extraditing people. We can go after the cash bail or the bondsman for that reimbursement. So we'd be losing that also. But one thing about cost that we haven't talked about is the fact that this $30 million is what is necessary for the public defenders. It doesn't count police overtime. It doesn't count sheriffs. It doesn't count, you know, how long folks are going to be sitting in jail waiting for their lawyer. And it doesn't count the cost to prosecutor's office if they want to show up at these hearings, which most people don't know now. So we're talking about an incredible cost, which, again, I don't think you're getting a lot of return for investment.
Very quickly, Dr. Moore, go around the room here.
Yeah, I just don't think we can ever underestimate the role of a lawyer at this first hearing. And it's become so important just to impress a community that has very little faith and confidence in the fairness of our jail system, of our court system. Lawyers are able to balance a playing field. They're able to speak for people. And what they're able to do is to provide a voice that otherwise people do not have. In terms of the Court of Appeals decision, you know, we would hope that a very basic principle of our legal system is stare decisis. It means that you don't just change a decision that you made 3 months ago because somebody doesn't like the decision. The Court of Appeals has been the one part of our government that actually has stood for the rights of poor people. They've done it several times now. When it gets to the legislative process, that's where you have very strong vested interests, Mark. And I don't mind saying that the bail bond industry, the insurance company, are part of that vested interest in wanting the system to remain the same. And there's also a small but vocal group of private lawyers who also benefit when people are in jail. Because when people are in jail, families will somehow find money to pay the private lawyer. Most criminal defense lawyers, most prosecutors, we understand that a justice system requires a public defender or a lawyer next to an accused person. Paul?
Yeah, thank you. I agree with everything Doug has said, and I think the most important point to remember is that the Court of Appeals has declared this to be a constitutional right. So we may some people may not like it, judges may not like it, Scott and his fellow prosecutors may not like it, but every time a constitutional right is declared, it does cost money. Doug mentioned the Gideon case that occurred 50 years ago. If you look at the funding for indigent defense across the country, and even here in Maryland, it's woefully underfunded. And that means that we have a system by which it favors people that have money. And so I guess we can go around and around on the issue of whether or not this decision is a proper one for Maryland and how much it's going to cost. But I think in the end, it's a constitutional right, and poor people have the same rights as everybody else. That's fundamentally what the court decision has said. With respect to what Scott said about returning somebody from another state and charging the cost to the bail bondsman, I think he would agree with me that that's the rare case. That's the rare case in which a bondsman actually does have to forfeit the money. By and large, people are returned to court by extradition process, by the warrant process, and those are served by our police and by our sheriffs. And I don't think the bail bond industry really adds any value at all to the criminal justice system. And the proof of that is those systems that have enacted the reforms that we have talked about, in which it treats people equitably and fairly, and their return rates to court and public safety haven't been, if anything, they've been enhanced. And so I think in closing, I think the decision obviously is a good one, and I think the cost of putting one lawyer at a hearing is being bandied about as a tremendous burden on the community, but the cost of over-incarcerating people, like they do in Baltimore City and in Prince George's County and throughout the state, is a much, much greater cost.
And Tom, a closing thought, because we really have
Mark,
2 minutes left.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to respond. The D.C. pretrial system costs taxpayers about $58 million. If this was extrapolated to Maryland, those costs could escalate to possibly even $500 million for some of the things that are being discussed. As far as Doug's comment about private lawyers, I mean, that couldn't be more wrong. We as private lawyers, who obviously we're not the same thing as what Paul does, the public defender's office, Oftentimes, it's a question as to whether or not the person can afford to pay the bail or get the private attorney. So the suggestion that somebody's sitting in jail, if anything, it would benefit us from that aspect. But again, you know, looking at the system in which bail bondsmen are on the hook, I don't know what the numbers are specifically about, you know, Scott saying about bail bondsmen being on the hook versus Doug saying it's a rare case or Paul saying it's a rare case. I don't think there's some specific numbers about that, but what I can tell you is that bail bondsmen have to get insurance companies, and the insurance companies back them. So if it's a situation where the bail bondsman is on the hook for an amount of money, the insurance company protects them. So, for example, if it's $1 million bail, you know, a very high bail, and somebody does skip, the insurance company protects them. So they have,
We have to kind of wrap this up, and I'm going to be like 30 seconds left here. Doug, you have 10 seconds. I can see you want to say something, but we don't have that much time.
I just think the risk assessment will help judges make informed decisions, fair decisions. That's something we all want.
And we're going to have all this on our website. You can peruse it at steinershow.org. Read the stuff for yourself. Look at the kind of the studies that have been come out from Kentucky and other states that have done away with the bail bond system and how people there think it has worked effectively and why. That'll be on our website. You can read those. And we'll continue this discussion between now and when this decision is handed down by the court, after it's handed down by the court again, and what's going to happen in the state legislature. This has become an issue we have followed intensely over the last 20 years, and we will continue to follow it to its fruition, if it is a fruition, in the state legislature this session. I want to thank all of our guests for coming here today. Really interesting discussion. Doug Colbert, University of Maryland School of Law, Paul DeWolf, our Chief Public Defender, Scott Schellenberg, Baltimore County State's Attorney, and Tom Moronic, Baltimore Attorney. Good to have the four of you with us, and it's been a great discussion. We'll keep at it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you all. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, Sam Cooks, you're always on my mind. Come back with Baynard Woods and the City Paper. Don't go away.
In my heart, you're always on my mind. Although we are apart, you're always, always on my mind. And baby, the reason why I know I can't forget your face, 'cause everywhere I go, I see you every place. You're all